This is Tyra Banks for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Essence. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Essence Magazine Online. What it means to be seen, a Black woman's journey to the World Cup. For Yvette Peggs, being selected as a city ambassador for the 2026 FIFA World Cup is about more than soccer. It is about service, visibility, and claiming space in a world that has not always planned for a presence. And this article is by Yvette Peggs. My journey to the World Cup was about more than soccer. I have learned to travel with a level of preparation most people never have to consider. Before I leave home, I calculate distance, timing, energy, accessibility, and what I will do if something does not go as planned. I think about how far I will need to move, where I can rest, whether the entrance I was promised is actually usable, and who I may need to advocate to along the way. Airports, events, and even opportunities come with invisible questions. Will I be able to move through this space safely? Will I be welcomed? Will I be seen or simply noticed? That has been my reality for much of my life as a Black woman in STEM, living with a disability. I know what it feels like to be highly visible while still not being fully considered. I have entered spaces where accessibility existed on paper but failed in practice, and professional environments where quietly conforming became part of how I survived and succeeded. Over time, I became skilled at preparing myself for places that had not necessarily prepared for someone like me. Being chosen as a FIFA City Ambassador for Atlanta changed everything. That is why receiving the email saying I had been selected as a City Ambassador for the 2026 FIFA World Cup carried so much weight. My first response was joy, but it was also awareness. This was more than a volunteer assignment connected to one of the largest sporting events in the world. It represented presence. It represented service. It represented stepping into a global moment where Black women and disabled women are not always historically visible beyond the audience. I have loved soccer for years, not only because of my culture and kids, but because of what it can create between people. Soccer crosses cultures, languages, neighborhoods, and generations. Service has always carried that same spirit for me. Both ask us to pay attention, work as a team, and contribute to something larger than ourselves. Volunteering for the World Cup felt like several parts of my life meeting in one place. My love of soccer, my commitment to service, my disability advocacy, and my belief that everyone should have a meaningful role. Soccer is often called the world's game, but access to its strongest pathways in the United States has not always been equal. Club fees, travel costs, transportation, geography, and limited representation have shaped who could easily imagine themselves on the field. Black women such as Kim Crabbe and Brianna Scurry, both pioneers on the pitch, helped widen that picture long before I ever put on a World Cup volunteer uniform. Their visibility mattered because seeing someone who reflects part of your own story can quietly expand what you believe is possible. During volunteer training in Atlanta, that truth became personal. I found myself surrounded by people from different countries, backgrounds, and experiences, all preparing to support the world's most significant sporting event. As I entered the space, I instinctively checked in with myself along the way. I always do in unfamiliar places. Could I navigate the room comfortably? Would I need help? Has the environment truly been designed for me to participate fully? Then something shifted. I was not thinking about whether I looked out of place. I was simply present. I was not there as a symbol, an exception, or an inspirational side note. I was there as part of the experience. In that moment, I became deeply aware of everything I carried into the room. A Black woman, a wheelchair user, a STEM professional, a soccer fan, and a person who understands what it means to arrive prepared for spaces that do not always prepare for you. The U.S. national power soccer team proves that soccer really is for all. People often see only the visible parts of moments like this. They see the FIFA credentials, the uniform, the smiling photos, and the opportunity. They do not see the calculations, backup plans, physical effort, and emotional energy required before arrival. For many disabled people, just being there is never as simple as it sounds. Showing up requires intention, adaptability, and the belief that you deserve to occupy spaces that may not have fully considered you. That is also why Power Soccer, a form of the sport designed for power wheelchair users, matters to me. Disabled people do not belong outside the game, limited to watching from accessible seating. We are athletes, strategists, volunteers, leaders, and fans. The United States Power Soccer Association national team proves that access is not only about where we are allowed to sit. It is about whether we are recognized as people with something valuable to contribute. Every step toward the World Cup has reminded me that belonging is not always handed to us. Sometimes we learn to carry it into the room ourselves. Visibility is not always loud or performative. Sometimes it is simply allowing yourself to be fully present, knowing that someone else may see you and begin to imagine a wider future for themselves, a future that resembles what they see in the mirror, their neighborhoods, and their wildest dreams. Black women have always found ways to build futures inside spaces that were never designed with us in mind. Disabled people have always found ways to participate, even when the invitation came late or not at all. Being all of me at the World Cup reminded me that I am part of that legacy. My job isn't to wait until every door opens. My job is to walk, or in my case, roll, through the ones that do, take them off the hinges, and make it easier for the next person to gain access. Yvette Peggs is founder and chief prevention officer of Your Invisible Disability Group, where she helps organizations prevent accessibility failures in high visibility environments. A STEM professional, disability advocate, and lifelong soccer fan, she has participated in more than 25 adaptive amateur sports since becoming a wheelchair user. After a competitive, months-long selection and training process, she was chosen from more than 37,000 Atlanta applicants to serve as a 2026 FIFA World Cup host city ambassador. Malcolm Jamal Warner's widow speaks about grief as a state dispute with late star's mother comes to light. Tanisha Warner speaks with Gail King as newly filed lawsuits involving Malcolm Jamal Warner's estate bring fresh attention to his legacy. And this article is by Okla Jones. A few days after the anniversary of Malcolm Jamal Warner's death, new details have emerged about an ongoing legal dispute involving his estate, just as his widow, Tanisha Warner, prepares to share her story publicly. In a preview of an upcoming CBS Mornings interview, Gail King asks Tanisha about her relationship with Pamela Warner, the late actor's mother, who now serves as trustee of the Warner Family Trust. The conversation was recorded before news of the lawsuit became public. Court filings revealed that Tanisha has filed lawsuits in Georgia and California, sneaking more than $1.2 million from the trust. According to court documents obtained by People, she alleges Malcolm Jamal Warner did not fulfill financial obligations outlined in the couple's 2022 premarital agreement before his death. Among the claims is an allegation that the actor agreed to obtain a $1 million term life insurance policy, naming Tanisha as the sole beneficiary, but never secured the policy. She also seeks payment tied to an anniversary provision in the agreement, a Roth IRA obligation, and compensation she says remains unpaid for her work as Warner's chief of staff. According to the filings, she is requesting interest, attorney's fees, and an order preventing trust assets from being distributed while the case is pending. For the last year, I have attempted to privately settle my beloved husband's complicated estate and honor his last wishes, said Tanisha Warner in a statement provided by her spokesperson after the lawsuit was filed. Malcolm had every intention to provide for our 9-year-old daughter and me. He was close to finalizing a new estate plan to replace the stale plan created in 1996 when he was 26 years old, 20 years before we met, and well before we gave birth to our beautiful daughter. Sadly, he was unable to do so before we lost him. Although the legal battle has now entered the public eye, Tanisha's interview with CBS Mornings focuses primarily on life after losing her husband. In the preview, she reflects on navigating grief while raising their daughter as a single parent. When King asks her about her relationship with Pamela Warner, Tanisha pauses before responding. Right now, everybody, all of his family members, and everyone who has lost him, they are grieving. You know, it's been the biggest loss for all of us. Malcolm Jamal Warner died in July of 2025 at the age of 54 after drowning while on vacation with his family in Costa Rica. His portrayal of Theo Huxtable on The Cosby Show made him one of the television's most recognizable actors, and his death prompted an outpouring of tributes from fans and colleagues. The entire interview of King's Sit Down with Tanisha Warner aired on July 23rd on CBS Mornings. How Wounds to Wisdom Turn Honest Conversations into a Documentary. Premiering at the Martha's Vineyard African American Film Festival, the project features Jonathan Majors, Dee Smoke, and everyday Black men sharing deeply personal stories. And this article is by Okla Jones. For several reasons, Black men have often been expected to carry life's burdens without complaint. Wounds to Wisdom, a new documentary premiering at the Martha's Vineyard African American Film Festival, asks what happens when they finally have the space to put those burdens down. Directed by Naja Alessi, Jonathan Jacobs, and Caden Hall, the film brings together actor Jonathan Majors, Grammy-nominated rapper Dee Smoke, and several everyday Black men for candid conversations about grief, identity, and mental health. Their stories grew out of Alessi's Wounds to Wisdom Supper Club, a gathering she has hosted for nearly a decade, where Black men are encouraged to speak honestly about their lives. This introspective project is something that Alessi had been passionate about due to the people that were already in her life. I have five Black brothers. I have a Black father, and all my cousins are boys, she tells Essence. So I grew up around Black men. That was my comfort zone. Those were the men that made me feel safe and seen. Alessi's understanding of mental health changed after losing her brother to suicide. Despite their close relationship, she realized there were parts of his life that she never fully understood. I saw the struggles that they went through. I saw the pain and the things that they encountered. But I didn't think that it really affected them, she says. I'm like, these are superheroes. They could do anything. But to watch my brother struggle for years with his mental health and ultimately pass away from that, I understood that there was a need for us to be able to see Black men in a different light. Dee Smoke immediately understood why the film mattered. Much of his contribution takes place inside a building he has watched change young lives for years. With Wounds to Wisdom, it just allowed me to do some more of the work that I was already doing with the young people, he says. Broadway Boxing Gym has always been something that was just a transformative space for the community. In addition to talking about healing, the documentary captures men actively working through life's challenges, and documenting those environments felt just as critical as the conversations themselves. To bring filmmakers in that space to properly document what naturally happens, and then the juxtaposition of all the training going on inside, and then stepping outside and encountering the police and all the things that we still have to navigate, that's super important to me, Dee Smoke says. This project is just necessary, and I hope these conversations keep happening. Majors believes conversations like these can help dismantle ideas many Black men have carried since childhood, and his participation in this project comes during a deeply personal chapter of his own life, making his reflections especially poignant. This journey has taught me that I am not my headlines, not my past, not the worst thing that has happened to me, Majors says. Jacobs hopes viewers recognize themselves in those stories, regardless of where they are in life, which is part of the reason why he believes MVAAFF provides the ideal setting to begin a broader discussion within the Black community. We wanted it to be something that would slow time down long enough for us to feel something, and then use that to be a catalyst to start a conversation, he says. Although the film features more recognizable names such as Majors and Dee Smoke, Alessi intentionally pairs their experiences with men audiences have never met before. Her goal is to remind viewers that emotional struggles do not discriminate based on career, income, or public profile. I want them to understand that they are not alone, she says. A lot of men are struggling with the same thing, and they can get through it with each other. That message ultimately gives Wounds to Wisdom its purpose. Rather than offering easy answers, the documentary invites Black men to begin conversations many have postponed for years. Sometimes being heard is the first step toward peace. Healing, for me, has been learning to tell the truth about who I am, to let my wife and my village see that truth, and to create art that makes room for all of our scars, not just our trophies, Major says. Mourning Nolan Xavier Wells. Why this loss feels so personal for the Black community. The untimely death of the promising 18-year-old Mississippi football star and the lack of answers surrounding it is unfortunately far too familiar for us. And this article is by Bridget Bartlett Royal. On Monday, July 20th, Nolan Xavier Wells was laid to rest at Center Point Church in his hometown of Ocean Springs, Mississippi. The handsome teen with a charming smile would have celebrated his 19th birthday on August 19th. He would have likely resumed classes at Southwest Mississippi Community College next month as well. It was there that Wells was majoring in business while playing wide receiver for the school's football team. His mother fondly recalls his magnetic personality and shares that he never met a stranger. She affectionately called him Nono. Instead of Wells' parents planning his golden birthday celebration or helping their deceased son register for his fall classes, they were selecting his casket and organizing a homegoing for their child. Prominent civil rights attorney Benjamin Crump is working with Nolan's parents, Christine Wells Wansley and Elmer Wansley Sr., to get answers surrounding his untimely death. Crump is working to find out what really happened on July 4th, 2026 on Horn Island, where what was supposed to be the destination of a fun day trip with friends turned out to be the last place Wells was seen alive. Other notable public figures have stepped in to help the family at this devastating time. The independent autopsy performed by forensic pathologist Roger Mitchell Jr., M.D., was paid for by former NFL quarterback and social justice champion Colin Kaepernick. Longtime activist Reverend Al Sharpton delivered the eulogy at Monday's service. He also announced a $50,000 reward for information leading to an arrest and conviction in the death of Wells. Media mogul Tyler Perry soon after matched that amount. NFL Hall of Famer Terrell Owens pledged $25,000 to the cause. Most of us cannot spare $50,000, $25,000, or even $5,000 to help this worthy cause, but that does not mean we haven't contributed to the cause in our own ways. Even as strangers, we have prayed, many of us have cried, we have envisioned Nolan on that boat with people he thought were his friends, and internally debated how differently things could have transpired that Saturday afternoon. We have thought with compassion about Nolan's parents, Christine and Elmore, and the pain that they have had to endure. We have sincerely kept Nolan's entire village in mind while trying to make sense of this tragedy. His siblings, grandparents, aunts, uncles, godparents, and cousins. Because we all know a Nolan, and we know a Christine, and an Elmore too. We know a young man who is full of light and promise and talent. We know parents who selflessly pour into their children and try to give them every opportunity possible. Parents who simply want to see their kids healthy, happy, and thriving, whatever thriving looks like for them. We know that no stage of parenting is easy, especially not parenting a young adult. We recognize the joy in Christine and Elmore's faces every time we see a picture of them with their son pop up on our timelines, and the comfort in Nolan's eyes as he was flanked by his parents, whether in his cap and gown or in his football uniform. Those eyes seemed to hold a palpable confidence, one that revealed Nolan knew he was loved and supported by his parents. Whether we are a parent of one child or half a dozen children, whether we are auntie, uncle, a caring neighbor, a concerned teacher, or just someone with a pulse and an ounce of humanity, we've all worried about a child's well-being. And when you factor in being a Black youth and in Mississippi, well, that's a deep-seated worry. To be clear, the tragedy of Nolan Xavier Wells could have occurred anywhere and to anyone, but we're not going to pretend the location of this death didn't make us pause. Mississippi, the same state where a 14-year-old Emmett Till was abducted and brutally lynched for allegedly whistling at a white woman who 53 years later admitted that her entire claim back in 1955 was a bold-faced lie. Mississippi has the highest recorded number of lynchings in the United States, with 581 documented deaths between 1882 and 1968. And that number is much higher when one considers how many went undocumented because Jim Crow. Yeah, that Mississippi. Again, this horrific event and the grim circumstances surrounding it could have happened in New York City, California, or Illinois, which is yet another reason it is so painful. The family wants answers, and so do we. Somebody knows something. Our collective grief is for Nolan, but also for the lack of justice that seems to be still in 2026 okay when it comes to our youth. And damn it, it hurts a lot. It hurts an indescribable hurt to think that the lives of our babies are not considered as precious as everyone else's. Like Christine Wells Wansley and Elmer Wansley Sr. didn't cheer for Nolan at the top of their lungs at his football games. Like they didn't hang his preschool artwork up on the fridge in their kitchen when he was in preschool. Like they weren't smiling ear to ear when he made the honor roll or aced a test they know he studied hard for. Somehow Black parents in their villages just aren't given the same grace, space, and dignity when it comes to our young people. This is why we're all mourning Nolan. Crump will hold a press conference in Chicago at the 117th NAACP National Convention on Wednesday, July 22nd, to announce the findings of an independent autopsy conducted in connection with the death of Wells. Family members, legal representatives, and the NAACP leadership are expected to be in attendance for the briefing. Hopefully some answers were revealed. The pain of knowing a mother and father had to bury their 18-year-old son and those involved, including the local authorities, still don't have any answers, will remain. Through tears, Christine expressed at her son Nolan's homegoing service, "Never stop saying his name. As long as we continue to remember him, his light will continue to shine through us all." So despite our collective anger, confusion, and hurt, we will oblige and offer our support to those who knew and loved this young man. For all we know, that community is our most powerful tool. The family has established an official GoFundMe account called In Loving Memory of Nolan Xavier Wells. Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority, Incorporated welcomed 6 honorary members at the 72nd International Boule. The new class brings together women whose accomplishments span medicine, Hollywood, Silicon Valley, and corporate America, continuing the sorority's tradition of recognizing exceptional leadership. This article is by Okla Jones. Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority, Incorporated added 6 accomplished women to its sisterhood during the organization's 72nd International Boule in Las Vegas. The sorority conferred honorary membership on vaccine scientist Dr. Kismikia Corbett-Alaire, actress, director, and producer LaTanya Richardson-Jackson, Emmy-nominated director Sally Richardson-Whitfield, actress and musician Pauletta Pearson-Washington, technology executive Merlene Saintil, and Salesforce President and Chief Operating and Financial Officer Robin Washington. Today, Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority, Incorporated welcomes 6 women whose influence extends far beyond their names, read the sorority's post on social media. They are scientists, innovators, artists, executives, and visionaries whose work has changed industries, opened doors, and created lasting impact. Not just trending, transformational. Not just accomplished, enduring, not just recognized, respected. Richardson Jackson has built a celebrated career on stage and screen, earning multiple Tony Award nominations, while also making history as the first woman to direct an August Wilson play on Broadway with The Piano Lesson. Richardson Whitfield continues to leave her mark behind the camera, directing acclaimed television series including Queen Sugar, Scandal, and Winning Time, The Rise of the Lakers Dynasty, which earned her a historic Emmy nomination. Saintil has spent decades helping shape the technology industry as a Silicon Valley executive, investor, and advocate for greater representation in corporate leadership. Washington oversees finance and operations at Salesforce, while also serving on Alphabet's board of directors. Pearson Washington rounds out the class with a career-spanning Broadway, film, and music. The 6 women were recognized during the ceremony, joining a distinguished group of honorary members whose work has influenced generations within their professions and beyond. under the leadership of International President and CEO Danette Anthony Reed. The organization continues to recognize women whose impact reflects Alpha Kappa Alpha's enduring commitment to scholarship, service, and leadership. And next we have LeBron James signs with the Philadelphia 76ers for a final NBA chapter. This article is by Okla Jones. LeBron James joined the Philadelphia 76ers after spending the past 8 seasons with the Los Angeles Lakers. The 22-time All-Star has agreed to a 2-year, $8 million contract with a player option, according to ESPN's Shams Charania, who cited Clutch Sports CEO Rich Paul. James announced that he had considered retiring following the 2025-26 season before ultimately deciding to continue playing. At 41, the 4-time NBA champion will enter his 24th NBA season with a new team and another opportunity to compete for a title. I thought I was done when the season ended. I wasn't ready to announce it, and I knew I needed some time to really decide, but I was pretty sure I played my last game, LeBron James wrote on X. I was honest at that last press conference when I said I needed to look at myself and decide if I still love this game. I still truly love this game, and I have more to give. Philadelphia spent much of the offseason assembling a roster capable of contending in the Eastern Conference. Earlier this summer, the franchise acquired 5-time All-Star and 2024 NBA Finals MVP, Jaylen Brown, pairing him with Joel Embiid and Tyrese Maxey. James now joins that group, giving the 76ers one of the league's most accomplished starting lineups heading into the new season. Per a report by ESPN, team executives and players reportedly played an active role in recruiting James. President of Basketball Operations Mike Ganzi, who previously worked with him in Cleveland, maintained communication with Rich Paul throughout free agency. Embiid, Maxey, and Brown also helped make Philadelphia's case as James evaluated where he wanted to spend the final years of his career. The move comes after James earned nearly $53 million with the Lakers last season, making his new contract a significant pay cut. Reports indicated that his priority during free agency was finding the best basketball situation rather than maximizing his salary. James arrives with one of the most decorated resumes in league history, a 4-time NBA champion, 4-time MVP, and 4-time Finals MVP. He remains the NBA's all-time leading scorer after more than 2 decades in the league. Last season, he averaged 20.9 points, 6.1 rebounds, and 7.2 assists. I believe I can help make the Philadelphia 76ers a championship team, and I'm so excited to energize a new fan base and start this incredible journey. One last time, James said on X. Thank you, LA, Miami, I'll love you forever, and Northeast Ohio will always be home. The 76ers have not won an NBA championship since 1983 and have not advanced beyond the second round of the playoffs since reaching the NBA Finals in 2001, with Allen Iverson leading the pack. By adding James to a promising roster, this organization is making one final push to end both droughts. And we have run out of time for this episode of Essence. We hope you enjoyed listening. I'm Tyra Banks, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Essence is available as a podcast at our website, NorthCarolinaReadingService.org. That's NCReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina.